once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And let's see, the telephone number in here, 254-258. No. 254-773-1400. I have too many numbers to remember.
Right. Numbers.
Numbers, yes. Reminds me, there's a really good Sunday essay in the Wall Street Journal today that's, I think, worth reading in defense of the dismal science. And it reminded me of something. The economics minister, the equivalent of the Secretary of the Treasury or whatever, for Greece, actually was convicted of treason in Greek courts. Did you know that?
I saw that, yeah.
And that's bad. And then the Congressional Budget Office, full of economists who say, if you pass this law, here's what it will cost.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bipartisan, and the head is appointed, then this particular head of the Congressional Budget Office is appointed by Republicans, very conservative sort of guy. And he was accused by the president of issuing fake news.
Right. Well, I mean, this is an important factor here. People in economics, when they're making predictions, whether it's a Congressional Budget Office, hopefully they're at a higher quality than the same folks that do this sort of thing in Greece, they're kind of like meteorologists. They've got to take readings from a lot of different things and come up with a forecast.
Mm-hmm.
And the forecast is not going to be 100% right. Much more, it's only going to be right most of the time.
Well, the guy in Greece, by the way, was convicted of treason because he actually did his accounting correctly. He actually added 2 and 2 equals 4 and did things like that.
Why did he do that?
Because
horrible.
He realized that the European Union that Greece
Shameful.
Was part of actually has a standard for accounting, and he applied the standard to the Greek budget.
That's and said, treasonous.
And said, you know, we have a much bigger debt than we thought we did.
Treason.
And so he was convicted in court of treason against – I don't know if – I was trying to figure out if he actually went to prison for that. To me, that would get him hired in a lot of places, the fact that he's honest. But economics is of all the social sciences – and I was reading about that in this article. It's certainly worth reading. It is the most scientific of all the social sciences.
Right.
It is the one with the most accurate predictions of all the social sciences, and it is the only one with a good mathematical basis. And we've learned a lot.
And it's right more often than it's wrong. It doesn't mean it's continually being improved,
right. But
it's right more often than it's wrong. And something we quote regularly, the leading economic indicators. We've never had a recession when the leading economic indicators have been positive for 6 months prior.
And they are positive right now, which means no recession for at least 6 months.
It's kind of like measuring heart rate. And if you've got a good, healthy heart rate going, it's at that moment, you're probably not having a heart attack. And that's one of those things that in economics, there are kind of shining examples of when it gets it right. Almost every time, there's a lot of places where it still gets it wrong a lot.
One of the problems with economics is a good economist will give advice to do something that is counterintuitive, that runs against your intuition, your gut, your emotional feeling. For example, we consider ourselves to be good economists.
Economists.
Whatever we are, yeah.
We are eco-warriors.
And as a result...
We fight for a different kind of green.
Right. As a result, we'll tell people when you're scared and you want to bail out of the market, that's a good time to stay in. And if you have extra money laying around, it's a good time to invest it. And when you feel irrationally exuberant and you want to jump on the latest Bitcoin or go-go hot stock or... You want to buy a whole bunch of
because
Amazon
it's
or Google
really,
or something.
It's really expensive at the moment. We should buy some.
Because it's gone up really, really fast. It's, quote, going up. There is no going, by the way, in the markets. We'll tell you, no, stick to the steady, true course and just keep putting one foot in front of the other.
What I said last hour, a year ago, we were talking about Bitcoin, and I said, don't buy it. A month ago, we were talking about Bitcoin, and I said, it's a gamble. A month ago, since then, Bitcoin has come up by 100%. So by taking the tried and true advice of someone involved with economics, you avoided 100% gain.
Maybe.
Well, people could have purchased in there and...
Have you ever tried to buy and then sell a Bitcoin?
That's rather more complicated than it's certain areas.
Kind of like
true.
People discover there's a huge spread on golds.
Right.
That sometimes...
But, you know, I'm saying be careful. It's a gamble, and there's no saying if you're... The reality is that gambling on commodities or on horse races or on anything else, there's ways to do it professionally, but you still have a very high probability of losing money. And I prefer to go the route where if you're creating value that people are wishing to pay for, you should expect to make a profit. And if you're buying a company that creates value and that you look at the fair market value of that value and you're not paying more than you should be for that, then you've got a really good potential for profit. It's kind of common sense. If you're opening a business and it's going to cost $2 million to open the business and it's going to pay you $2,000 a month, it's probably not the best use of your money. If you're creating something with that price that's going to create enough value that people are going to pay you enough to make a good return on your money, then that's a good business decision. That equation doesn't work with Bitcoin. You're not creating anything. You're just holding it and hoping someone will pay you more. You can make a lot of money doing that, but you can also lose a lot of money doing that. And last hour I said I wanted to talk about the record break.
Yeah, I'm waiting to hear about the record break.
Okay. This is the longest streak since 2004 of a net outflow from equities in the United States.
Good.
Money leaving the stock market in the United States. Over the past 10 weeks, about $30 billion has net left the stock market, which as a percentage of the stock market is pretty small. But this is the longest streak of money leaving the stock market since 2004. That includes the Great Recession.
That is exciting.
It's exciting to me, too. What it means is that people are not exuberant about stocks right now, which is the greatest argument that anybody could give about stocks not being overvalued. I think they are fairly valued at the moment. And the fact that there's a gradual small net amount of money leaving the stock market rather than going into it. There's been a similar streak of money going into bonds during that same time period, by the way, and to emerging markets, but it's a really long period where emerging markets weren't getting any money. So the fact that the bonds are getting a huge amount of money right now when interest rates are we just took a dip in interest rates and people are buying more bonds, that may be correlated. There may be maybe why the interest rates.
It is exactly why.
But the concept that people are piling on that when they are in essence saying you better hold the bond until maturity or you're going to lose money on it because interest rates are so low right now, they're going to come up at some point.
Well, we've been saying that a long time too.
Yeah, there you go. Tried and true economics. And
you know, we saw interest rates at record lows and they still are. Not as low as they were last summer at this time. But, you know, when you see your interest rates consistently at record low levels, you figure they're more likely to go up than go down. And we've been saying that for several years. And it's one of those things we've just got to live with. We got to just hang in there because it's kind of like the stock market began to be overpriced in 1995. By, say, the stock market, the S&P 500, which we don't use as an investment. Value stocks were still in good shape, and they continue to be in good shape. Right on into 2002, but the main index, the S&P 500 in 1995, started to get pretty clearly off its trend line, overvalued. The price-to-earnings ratio was too high, and it kept going higher, and it kept going higher. And for 5 years, it stayed overvalued and got more overvalued. And I can tell you from personal experience, I had some people very unhappy at me because we weren't getting into the go-go growth stocks. And the people who did get into the go-go growth stocks were really, really unhappy later on when the bottom fell out. it's one of those things where a good economist will advise you to do things that are very counterintuitive. A good economist will tell you to have a good cash reserve. And you say, yeah, but I'm not making any money on my cash reserve. And their answer to you should be, yeah, but you're not. That's where you avoid loss when everything falls apart. And you got to, it's kind of like the spare tire in your car does not cause the car to go faster or improve your gas mileage. Therefore, you should get rid of the spare tire in your car. And of course, that's not true. It's pretty critical to have a spare tire in a car. It's pretty, it certainly does not lower the cost or improve the gas mileage or improve the acceleration or anything else to have two complete brake sets in your car. I don't know if you know this, but you have two complete hydraulic brake systems in your car so that if one of them fails, you can stop the car with the other one. That raises the price of the car. It doesn't increase the gas mileage. It doesn't increase the acceleration. It doesn't give you more power. It doesn't do anything for you until you need it. And hopefully you'll never need it, but you need to have it there anyway. And it's one of those crazy things that's going on. It's another thing, to change subject if I could. Sure. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And the telephone number to call in here is 773-1400, area code 254-773-1400, if you'd like to join with us. We've had a nice round figure of calls today.
Very round figure.
Yes. If you put a 1 in front of it, it would be much better.
If you put the 1 in front of a lot of things, it would be better.
Right. But that's 1 is the loneliest number, so.
Right.
Anyway, it looks like now that since as we've got nearly all of the earnings reports in for the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, all 500 companies, about 97% have reported. And for the second quarter, it looks like earnings year over year grew at 12%. Now, you want to know an interesting coincidence that makes me very happy? At the beginning of the first hour, I said what the growth year over year in the stock market was. Do you remember that? 12%, roughly.
Right.
I think 12.63%. And the earnings growth year over year, admittedly, that's back in the second quarter now. They're reporting earnings, and we're gradually crawling towards the end of the third quarter now. But the point is that we've seen earnings growth in the corporations that make up roughly 80% of the United States market and a big piece of our economy grow by 12% in the last 12 months. That's impressive. But there's the question, and we've addressed this in the newsletter and we've talked about it a little bit on the air, but it's one of those things that I don't hear anybody else asking. Well, one or two economists asked it, but other than that, if the United States economy is only growing at about 2% average per year,
right?
How is it in the United States economy, the gross domestic product is in fact the earnings, the profits generated in the total United States. If the United States economy is only generating roughly 2% growth in earnings a year, how is it that this big chunk of the United States economy called the Standard & Poor's 500 is seeing 12% growth per year? Why?
And it's
those
earnings. That's the same concept as when GDP is calculated. Right.
If the S&P 500 was a nation, it would have a GDP growth of 12%, which would make China look like a pop gun.
Right.
And the answer is, I wonder if anybody actually can call in and tell us what the
answer. I know the answer.
Well, you cheat, though. You read the newsletter.
You also read statistics and read the data.
You read stuff. You don't just watch television. The telephone's not ringing.
Well, 773-1400, 254-773-1400, nobody knows. Or either that or they're not listening, which I wouldn't be listening, so that's all right.
Well, since nobody's calling in, I'll just go ahead and tell you. It is because that extra 10% growth in the last 12 months has occurred outside the United States.
And it's not quite 10%, but that's a good round number to apply to it if we got a 2%
GDP.
Traditionally, the earnings of the stock market as a whole is a factor of 4 to the GDP. So because most institutions aren't trying to grow their profit drastically, they're trying to keep, you know, if you think mom and pop stores, you even think of semi-large
father
businesses.
Father and son businesses.
Right, they're just trying to keep the assets as they are and not grow it drastically.
They're trying not to lose their assets.
Right, please cover your assets. So the concept there is that the companies that are purchased by the public with the intent of raising their earnings tend to have a higher earnings growth than the others, but a factor of four, that means 8%. So we've got 4% of the growth of the S&P 500 taking place outside the United States.
Which, when I went back and researched that, I was going to get to that. The point is that, it, sure enough, about a third of the total earnings of the S&P 500 corporations come from outside the United States.
Right.
That's wonderful. And the reason I say that's wonderful is if you invest in, and I'm just going to say you invest in a domestic stock mutual fund or something like that, and it's broadly diversified, there's a pretty high probability that a big chunk of the gains you're seeing in your portfolio are coming because the rest of the world is doing well. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah, this is Frank. You know, I've got some stocks and bonds and mutual funds. And,
you have my sympathy.
Yeah. Well, I'm not really a sophisticated investor by any means, but it seems like, I mean, we talk about 12% over the last year. How much of this is the Trump bump? And also, how much he may have a hard time getting the tax cut that I think so much of this, especially the corporate tax cut, that so much of this growth has been off.
Well, you know, I think there is no Trump bump at this point. I know that sounds a little strange because it's been in the news. And when we talk about earnings, we're talking about taxes have been paid.
Yeah, earnings are net.
So there's very little speculation, and there's a lot of talk about speculation in the market that the market is up because we expect earnings to go up because taxes will be cut, or we expect President Trump to do wonderful things. If you actually run a trend line from a couple of years ago right through now, what you see is a dip, not a bump. The back end of the dip looks like a bump. That's what's called the Trump bump.
Right. The dip took place during the election season.
Yeah, during the election season, when both candidates were bad-mouthing the United States economy, the stock market went down. And then it came back up again, and that was called the Trump bump.
Right. And that's, by the way, that's not a dig at either candidate there to say that they were bad-mouthing the United States economy. To get elected, any person has to say, show where things are broken and how they'll fix it. That's just political rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got two candidates that are both talking about how broken everything is and how they're going to fix it, and they do it for 15 months at a time, you tend to have a dip in the market.
Jake has pointed out something that's, I think, I've gone back and checked it. Whenever the incumbent president is not running because he can't, it's the end of a two-term president, and you have two candidates running who are neither incumbent, you have a dip in the market during that period. And then at the tail end, at that election, and it doesn't make any difference whether Democrat or Republican gets elected, the market jumps upward suddenly. But when it jumps upward, it simply goes back to its trend line that it was on before.
Yeah, you can go back to our podcasts on our website for September and October of last year, before the election. And we talked about how it doesn't matter who's elected. Once the election's over, you're going to have a bump in the market because we've had a lot of earnings growth during the period where the market hasn't been responding to it because they've been too caught up in this mud-flinging match of wrestling with pigs.
The jump that you saw this week, the massive jump of, what was it, 0.72%?
Right, massive jump.
0.72% is because participants in the market think that we may get the tax break. Now, the other thing is, I can tell you that a move of less than 1% in a week is just noise, and somebody's trying to figure out why it's happening.
Right. There may not be a reason for 0.72%. It just could be people, you know, somebody put some money in the market. A lot of people did, because it's their daily thing.
Actually, the market's pretty boring, and every day newscasters have to come up with something exciting to say about something that's pretty boring most of the time.
And if you look what's happened in the stock market since February, it's been relatively flat. It's been flat with some downturns. When you hear about records being broken, it's records from February. So the Trump bump was a very nice label that people were putting on it. We've had it climb through these very crawling climbs through the records, very slow motion. if people were honestly pushing us to new records based on real anticipation of regulatory or tax reform, we would see a lot faster growth, because the impact of that would be on earnings, would be a boost of, on the math. If you look at the 12% earnings, that'd be more like 16% earnings.
Right. In other words, what we were saying just a moment ago is that a year ago at this point, the market was at a level, it's now 12% higher, and so are the earnings, which means that the market price to earnings ratio
is about the same,
has remained the same for the last year. It's like nothing happened.
Well, as a businessman, regulation has consumed probably 40% of my time.
Yes, sir. We can say amen to that.
Too much.
So go ahead.
I mean, businesses that are highly regulated, they take a lot of an awful lot of time, an awful lot of compliance help from people who are specialists in it.
Right.
Now, and when I see Trump, I'm going to reduce your regulations, and Hillary, I'm going to increase them. Basically, that's the history of her party. Basically, I'm more enthusiastic. I'm more, in fact, investing more business. You know, I've seen a lot of my business has picked up. My regulation hasn't rolled off yet, but I think it will. The state has to back off some of its requirements.
Well, could I ask what business you're in and where it is?
I'm in the mining business.
Okay, and where do you do the mining?
In Williams County.
Okay, gotcha. All right. You're right. It has picked up, and the whole economy has done very well. As a matter of fact, I think in the third quarter, what was it you said? 3.6% growth.
3.4 is the GDP now estimate from the Fed in Atlanta.
We're seeing at this point a diminishing in the negativity that was associated with the Great Recession, and people are starting to come back around. We were talking about, I would imagine that if you're mining in Williamson County, some of the stuff you're mining is going into houses, right?
Houses and roads.
Yes, and we're seeing across the board in Texas, and Texas is its own economy to the point, and a little sidelight here. The Economist reports on the economy in Texas
like it's
about
its
as much
country.
As it reports on the economy in
Italy,
in the United States. It's as if Texas and the United States are two countries occupying the same continent. But we are seeing an excellent rebound in Texas, and as people we were talking about earlier, upper end houses are doing well. Their prices are going up and people are building them. And there is some good infrastructure activity going on here in Texas. I don't know how much that's going on in the rest of the country, but you're in the right place at the right time. And I agree with you completely. The business, our business, everybody's business has picked up from where we are in the Salado area. I can tell you business is booming relatively, but that all has to completely to do with the fact that you gave us a lot of gravel or whatever to build a 4-lane highway and they got done with it.
Right. They finished it. Thank you very much for supplying us, by the way. There's another factor here in that the entire economy has been gearing up for what's been happening this year for the past 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And going back 3 years in our podcast, you'll hear us talking about 2017, that durable good orders are on track there, and hiring trends and all of the things, if they just keep doing without lots of bumps, will come through to a big boost in 2017.
You started to say something. Go ahead.
I'm sitting here listening, trying to learn.
Yeah, okay. And I think, very frankly, we got some good times ahead. There's going to be some bumps along the way. Don't misunderstand me. But the economy of the United States is in a position to grow at this point. And I was going to bring this up later, but I'll maybe talk about it later. But there's a key element here. You produce a part of something that's bigger. And in order for the thing that you produce the parts for, the materials for, in order for that demand to be there, there also has to be the supply from everybody else that's putting things into it. And you're going to think this is a little strange, but one of the best pieces of news to come out this week is the report that literally every one of the 45 nations tracked by the OECD, basically the organization that says, hey, let's develop nations, let's cooperate with each other and grow. Every one of those 45 nations is now reporting a year-over-year growth for the first time since 2007. And when we get the entire globe growing together,
that's a good, healthy sign. And nobody's doing it in a way that we would consider overheated.
Right. We get this synergistic effect. I don't know. I'm sure you notice it. An awful lot of stuff that you buy and an awful lot of stuff that goes into houses and roads and everything else comes from outside the United States. It's critical that the entire globe grow together. And one of the reasons we've had slow growth in the recent past is because we've been the only economy growing in many cases. And very gradually, the rest of the economies are starting to pick up and join with us. And as they do,
our
the synergy
will pick up too.
Of all of us will cause all of us to grow together. Now, at some point, we'll get too excited about that, but that's a few years down the road, and then we'll fall on our faces again. I can say that with some degree of confidence. No guarantees of the future.
I can say it's confidence because this is the way we do it every time,
right,
as a nation,
right,
or the world.
But what we're seeing is, I think you're headed into some good times, and I think the rest of us are too. And we're at that point on the S&P 500, which reflects the economy in many ways, of coming back to trend line. We are transitioning from recovery, and I think, tell me if you agree with this, by the way, from your own personal experience, from recovery to expansion. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'd like to go back and just, to the regulatory side of stuff.
Yeah.
I have now 18 different environmental permits, soon to have 22 new environmental permits.
Congratulations.
Through TCEQ. It's overwhelming. You could buy some new equipment. You could hire some more people. You could give raises if you didn't have to pay some compliance company to do these things constantly and mess with the really ridiculous regulations that will not make the water one drop cleaner.
It's kind of funny because Texas is arguably one of the most conservative states in that area. I just don't, frankly, I completely agree with you. Remember when it was called Trainwreck? That organization is now the TCEQ. And the point is, we elect people here in Texas who go to the state legislature and they put these restrictions on us. I don't really get how we can elect such a conservative legislature that concerns itself with who's was showing your birth certificates before using the bathroom when the TCEQ is wrecking business in the state. I don't understand that.
I have contributed to my various state politicians, and at one time I looked at what the bills were in front of it, there were 42 different abortion bills and 18 different bathroom bills, and nothing that said, "Hey, we're going to give you Texans some more freedom." Zero.
Yeah, and this is one of the. I'm going to get political here for just a second, okay? One of the things I don't understand about the Republican Party in Texas or anywhere else right now, and I am a lifelong Republican, is how can a party that traditionally has stood for individual freedom be so insistent on putting more restrictions on things? I don't get that. And frankly, I think you and I and everybody else that has any sense around here, let's not worry about what goes on in Washington so much. Let's turn around to the state of Texas. We got 2 years before the next legislative session. Let's put some pressure on our legislatures to put their money, put their time and their vote where they're supposed to be and take some of the restrictions off of Texans and give us a little more freedom to go about our business and to do business in manners that's not hurting anybody, where we can make some money and hire some more people.
Right. I think a very reasonable use of a special session would be to look at the environmental impact and whether or not they're saving anything by requiring people to have 22 different environmental impact permit studies and compliance, and what the long-term benefit to the ecology is to that, because in many cases they can't correlate any benefit to all of the compliance work that you're doing. It's insane.
Yeah, we live that too. 40% is probably a good number for us too.
So, some of it is absolutely ridiculous. I'm in the Edwards Aquifer contributing zone. There is 415 pages in the Edwards Aquifer regulations. It's overwhelming.
And the idea behind it, I think you and I can agree, we don't want the Edwards Aquifer to be
polluted.
A polluted, nasty thing. But when you've got to figure out 400 pages that reference each other and they don't have complete sentences because they say as written in section fill in the blank, and then you go to that section and it's referring to three other sections, it's written in a way that makes it nearly impossible to actually do it properly. You've got to hire people just to do it, and that's before you do anything.
And the, you know, frankly, I don't know that this is true, but it certainly makes an interesting conspiracy theory. We send a bunch of lawyers to Austin, and they write things that only lawyers can read, and their law firms then benefit from the fact that regular citizens can't read that stuff. They have to hire a lawyer to read it. He'll charge you $250 an hour. And never mind, I could go off on this all
right. Appreciate the call, sir.
We are brothers. Thank you for calling.
All right.
Telephone number remains 773-1400, 254-773-1400, and we do need to play some commercials.
Before we do that, though, I'm going to bring something up that Cornell and Washington University have agreed with me. Therefore, they must be very smart people. Over there at those universities somewhere.
They have agreed that the Salado salamander is a joke?
No. I wouldn't say it's a joke. You know, I would just be
very
careful.
No one has seen one
about,
in 22 years.
The thing that I'm talking about is that they've just done a set of research where they talk about, I'm going to drop some numbers here that sound ridiculous, and it's fantastically ridiculous. 11.1% of Americans are in the top 1%. At some point in their life. So that at some point in their life, if you leave it off, it just makes the math really great. 11.1% of people that make an income in the United States will at some point in their life for a year be in the top 1%. There's only 1.1% of the people in the 1%. So that's... You're talking.
I like your logic
huge,
there.
So huge.
So far, so good.
That are in that category for 10 plus years. So when people are railing against the one percenters, what they're really railing against are people that started a business that they have held together with shoestrings and baling wire and bubble gum for their entire professional careers and then sold the business. In 1 year,
I represent that.
Right. And got a huge amount of money, which if you separate it across the 40 plus years that they put that money together, they're suddenly considered the top 1% and they get things thrown at them by the left regularly. They have protests in their name and honor. And I just have to say, guys, we have to look at the numbers as more than numbers. They're people. And you have to ask, how did they get there? If there was 1% of the population that was always in the top 1%, we would have a class system. We would have a system that is so clearly classist that we would have a nobility.
It'd be called classic.
Right. It's the opposite of communism, by the way. They have no class.
As long as we're throwing in stuff before the commercials,
right.
I wanted to throw in something I did not want to avoid mentioning. There's something really positive going on in the discussions about tax reform. Actually, the tax reform is unlikely to happen. What we're going to get is tax cut. But here is – they got to find a bunch of revenue. That's a technical term, bunch.
Right, bunch.
Congress, in order to cut your taxes, my taxes, and corporate taxes, has got to find someplace else where they can bring more taxes in. One of the things they were considering, the House of Representatives considered, and Paul Ryan thought was a great idea, was a border tax, in essence.
where if something is brought in to the United States and sold in the United States from outside the United States, that the company that's selling it can't deduct the cost from its income taxes. That would effectively raise the it's called a border adjustment tax. It would effectively raise the cost of almost everything, for example, at Walmart or Target or someplace like that by about 20%. And once people started figuring out that that basically is taxing all the people, making all the people at Walmart pay the taxes for the corporations to get their taxes cut, that didn't go real well. But they've come up with a new solution, and it's being floated around, and that's one of the reasons that the leaders in Congress think they may get tax reform through, and that is to eliminate the deductibility of interest, not on mortgages, but for businesses. For corporations, and they haven't narrowed it down to whether it applied to small businesses as well. If any of you have any comments on that, particularly the caller a few minutes ago who's in business, I'd be interested in knowing about that. What they're talking about doing is cutting the corporate tax down to 20 to 23% from the current 35% that really runs up to about 40 in some cases. Cutting it down to around 20 to 23%. Which would make it reasonably competitive, doing a small tax. Nobody has been able to figure out exactly what the president is wants to bring money back in the United States with no taxes on it. But so corporations can bring money they're holding overseas back into the United States. But they finally figured out a way to pay for it that I think may actually work, which is to cut the deductibility of interest so that companies can no longer deduct from their income tax as they deduct from their income the interest that they're paying on loans. That will reduce the indebtedness, certainly. I don't know. Anybody got any thoughts on that? You're welcome to give us a call, but we do need to do some commercials.
Yeah, we'll be back on the other side. If you want to give us a call here at the Personal Wealth Coach, the number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number's in here. Telephone number. Is it numbers or number?
Well, it's a lot of digits put together, but is it one number? Because they don't.
Okay. The telephone digits in here
right.
are 254-773-1400 or is 254-773-1400 if you're talking about the telephone number is or the digits are. And if you're an English teacher, maybe you can talk to us about it. But we do have a caller on 254-773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Sandy. I live up in Temple.
Hello, Sandy and Von Temple.
I'm retired, and I have several rental houses that I've, you know, saved and invested for.
Mm-hmm.
But when they talk about reducing business in tax, business interest as and not allowing it as a tax deduction, what do you think that does with rental property interest on mortgages?
Now Congress has not determined this. The president's the Secretary of the Treasury has and Steve Cohen, his economic guru, has said they're going to leave this up to Congress how they handle it, which is a bad idea in my opinion. They should tell Congress handle it this way because Congress negotiate in 12 days. I don't think so, but. They haven't said clearly whether they're just going to do this with corporations or whether they're going to do it across the board for all commercial activities.
What I can say with – this is Jake – with a great deal of certainty is that my thought is that the debt ceiling is going to get raised way before we do any kind of tax reform.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the they float these ideas to see if they can get a response from the public. And your response right there of saying, well, who does it affect?
Yeah.
They haven't said.
Well,
so
if Congress passes tax reform and they say we're going to cut your individual income tax rates and we're going to cut your corporate tax rates by eliminating the commercial debt deduction. Commercial interest deduction, then your rental house prices will drop.
I can tell you that because I saw that happen one time.
Right. It causes people not to buy the rental house, that lowers the price.
I mean, basically, it says right now you pay a certain amount of money to a bank, a mortgage company, and then you get a certain amount of that money back as a tax refund, in effect, or a tax deduction, which reduces it reduces the cost of owning the house. So if you raise the cost of owning a rental property, then it's going to lower the value of the rental property. And then they made it clear that they won't accept household mortgage cuts. In other words, household mortgages will stay deductible.
That's your golden unicorn. Don't touch that.
It is. And if you wanted to get involved in this early on and write John Carter and say, hey, you can apply this to big corporations if you want to, but don't apply it to my rental property.
And that's the problem with any tax reform.
I'm realistic about that. Everybody, some people get dinged, but unless you're buying a property once the prices have dropped and can afford to pay that interest as part of, if the prices of rental properties drop, it would follow that rents possibly might drop.
I don't know.
It still leaves you in the same situation. You can't afford to own a rental house.
I don't know that it would cause rents to drop. Rents are going to be a factor of supply and demand. If there's people who want someplace to live and they're not in a position to buy a house, they got to rent. And there's only so many rental properties available. And I don't know if you, at least nationwide, you probably have a better feel for this than I do. The multifamily housing construction has leveled off. It hasn't dropped, but it leveled off, and it was going like gangbusters. And we're still forming new households, but they're running out of places to put new multifamily structures. So I don't know. I couldn't really forecast what's going to happen to the rents, but I can tell you that if the rents stay the same,
I can tell you.
Okay,
throw this in here. This is one of those weird shifts that happens with tax policy. If they remove the deduction for the mortgage interest on rental properties that are for investment use, what happens is that your bottom line profit drops, your margin drops.
And there really isn't any.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. You're hoping on appreciation.
So you and everybody else in the same boat with you have to raise the rents a little bit while the cost to buy your property drops.
Right. Not a good situation.
Right. It's a opposite movement from rent prices going up while the underlying property value drops. And this happens when there's artificial policy decisions that go on top of a market situation.
I don't know if this applies to your individual situation, and you have much better in-depth knowledge of it than I do. But what I've seen in the years as I've been analyzing people who own rental properties is there's some people who make a lot of money and there's other people who don't. And the ones who don't, in many cases, are not even aware of the fact that they're feeding their rental property. And then when they sell it, they have a lot of taxes to pay on the depreciation.
Yeah,
and they didn't actually have a gain, but they had to pay taxes on their non-gain. And they held the rental property. The only reason they could hold those individual properties as rental properties successfully is because of the tax breaks. It's kind of like farmers. A lot of farmers.
The CPA sells the idea.
Yeah, but let me say that there are people who make money. What they do is they buy either foreclosed or properties that are being sold out of rental that are in really terrible condition. And then they go in and they spend 6 months or so fixing the place up. Sometimes they hold them for as long as a year and rent them out. And then they sell them at a much higher price because they've gone in and cleaned it up and made it look nice.
Right.
Those
charge
people,
more for
right,
it.
There's two sets of people that I've seen made money doing what you're doing, and that's the people who fix the places up and the people who bought in 1991 when the bottom fell out of the rental properties.
Or in 2009
right
when the bottom was dropping.
And or have property in a place that as – fortunes go all of a sudden. The price of homes skyrockets.
Yeah, and that's
and
one
I
of those things.
Sold a house like that in another state, but unusual.
I'm talking about locally, and the issue is
you
if you're betting, and a matter of fact, I've known over a long period of time,
I had some people that I was able to follow their finances very carefully, who had lots of individual, mostly they were real estate agents, who had individual properties, individual single-family houses around the area that they'd been picking up when people left and couldn't sell them. They just picked them up for the payments. And they thought they were making money, and when they finally liquidated and finally got out, every one of them, if you actually run the numbers, they fed those things for years. They worked their tails off for years.
Yep.
And they actually lost money.
This is a truism. If you go back to the founding of our nation and you look at the trend lines for real estate values, they tend to appreciate with taxes and inflation. That's it. That the long-term trend line is, unless you're adding square footage, the value...
Yeah, unless you're improving the property.
If you improve the property, and in cases where the value of the underlying property didn't go up, you could still make an income off of someone renting it for you, but the price of the rent is set by the marketplace based on somebody buying it at a much lower rate than the market rate right now. So if you could buy it, the current residences that you're renting out at half the market rate today and charge the same rent, it would look really great. But that's enough people got into this market that it's particularly in Central Texas, that it is a highly competitive market in both rent and in property value, which means that the property value is, if you look around right now, we're at not necessarily a peak, but the property value on rental properties is high right now. If you look around and say, I want to buy a house that I'm going to rent out, what you'll find is if you do the math with the existing values on offer, you're not going to make a profit. And that's just, unless you find a strange deal where somebody's offering a house for sale for a lot less than the going rate, which probably implies a lot of work needs to go into it.
And you can buy a lot and build a duplex or a fourplex on it and sell it and make a nice profit.
If you can find the people to build for you, which is really difficult to do right now.
And can find the lots, because I understand builders are having a hard time finding lots.
Yeah, that's one of the problems that we're running into. And you're right into economics. This is one of the more fascinating issues, and we've been studying it for years, and it continues to be we're geeks.
I've spent a bunch of time studying, from my point of view too, and so that's why I thought I'd call in and throw it out there.
Well, thank you.
See what you had to say.
I
appreciate what you're doing. No, seriously, you are providing, your capital is providing places for people to live.
Well, that's not who I'm planning to do charity for.
No, I understand that, but that is...
I've got plenty of people in my own family.
That's right, but see, that's what Adam Smith, who is our guru, if you will, the guy who founded modern economics.
Yeah, I know.
The invisible hand. I mean, the bottom line to it is you're trying to make a profit, and in the process of legitimately, with a certain level of freedom, trying to make a profit for yourself.
You're providing a value that people are willing to pay for at a price they're willing to pay.
You're bettering society. So I just want to let you know, I you know, like we have, 10 employees?
Yeah.
10 employees. 10.
They all need places.
They only need places to live. We provide, we're in business to try to make a living, so we can live reasonably well. But in the process, we're enabling 10 people to make a living and to live reasonably well. And that wasn't our intent, but it's certainly working out very nicely.
That was a nice way of making it work. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, thank you for what you do.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to expect an answer right now, but I'll throw that the other side of this is, well, what do you do when you've got what you think you should have in other investments, and you don't want to put any more in that kind of a situation either?
You go talk to a registered investment advisor.
Yeah, somebody that's a fiduciary that's going to look at the value of real estate.
Yeah, I got your number.
that is now not necessarily. I'm not saying I'm not advertising for us, but they need to have. They need to be.
Some answers.
They need to be A, an independent investment advisor who will be a fiduciary, and B, have certifications like CFP or CIMA or something like that.
CFA, something nice.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. Thank you for calling. All right. Bye-bye. That was cool.
It was cool.
Did we already
did
commercials? Yes. Okay. We're running out of time.
We've only got about 2.5 minutes left for our week.
There is a very good article in the Wall Street Journal this week, and you'd probably, you know, I'd be glad to let you know something about it, but it's 19 questions you should ask your financial advisor. It's in Money Beat, the Intelligent Investor. Let's see if I can find the August 25th, Jason Zweig. You can go on the net and pick it up. Wall Street Journal, the 19 questions to ask your financial advisor. It is an excellent, excellent, excellent article. I'm going to probably bump this forward to next week so I can talk about it. Matter of fact, I may do it in my portion of the newsletter. But the point is, there is a very, very important thing, and that is to find out, and you get this in writing, this is crucial, and I'll run them through them real quickly. We have enough time? Yeah.
If you're quick.
And you get an answer in writing. Are you always a fiduciary, and will you state that in writing? And the answer should be yes. Two, does anybody else ever pay you to advise me, and if so, do you earn more to recommend certain products or services? And that should be no. If you get this in writing, do you participate in any sales contests or award programs, creating incentives to favor vendors?
They should say no to that. They probably won't.
Will you itemize all your fees and experiences in writing? And it should be yes. Are your fees negotiable? It should be yes. Will you consider charging by the hour retainer instead of an annual fee? Yes. Can you tell me about your conflicts of interest orally and in writing? So the ideal is, yes, I can tell you what they are, and no, I don't have any conflicts. That's the answer that should come up. And if you get and it's worth going to, and we got to go, and you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to give us a call, we have voicemail over the weekend and live people during the week, and the local telephone number is 254-947. Now, this is hard. 254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got podcasts. We've got newsletters. We've got philosophy, all kinds of good stuff up there. If you would like to email us directly, you can email Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.